evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 5, 2019. President Salva Kiir apologizes to the people of Wau State.
What happened among the SPLM leaders is the main cause of your suffering, and the same SPLM which fought for so long to liberate this country. They fought among themselves as they struggled for power.
And South Sudanese oil workers threaten to go on strike.
In terms of pay, it's not equal because, like me, I am a supervisor. So the difference between me and my crossship, who is not nationalist, is there is a very great difference. So as we bear the same impact of chemical hazard and we bear the same consequences.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir, who is on a two-week tour of the Bahr al-Ghazal area, has apologized to the people of Wau State on behalf of ruling SPLM party leaders for the suffering they have endured during the conflict. The president called on the people of Wau to avoid revenge attacks on others who may have hurt them during the war. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Wau.
President Kiir resumed his tour of Bahr al-Ghazal region today after interrupting it on Monday to receive the Eritrean and Ethiopian heads of state. Addressing hundreds of Wau residents at Wau Stadium today, Mr. Kiir admitted the ruling SPLM party is the blame for the continued power struggle in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, President Kiir says it is the conflict among the power-hungry politicians that brought suffering for the entire nation.
What happened among the SPLM leaders is the main cause of your suffering, and it is the same SPLM which fought for so long to liberate this country. They fought among themselves as they struggled for power. As a leader, I accept that these things happened, even though I did not do anything wrong myself. I see that I am also on the wrong side, as my party is the main cause of the suffering of my own people.
Mr. Kiir says, with a peace deal in place, people should reconcile and peacefully coexist. He says he is aware that many families have lost loved ones over the long conflict, but he is asking South Sudanese to forgive one another and move forward as one nation.
I need you to forget about what happened in the past and hold your hands together. I need my people to live peacefully with one another. I'm aware that many of you have lost many of your relatives during the conflict. Please don't revenge. I don't want to hear anything of that kind.
Mr. Kiir also appealed to the hold-out rebel groups that did not sign last year's revitalized peace agreement to lay down their arms and join the peace process. He also called on the IDPs sheltering in the UN-run protection of civilian sites, churches and schools' compounds to return home. The president admitted that the agreement is being implemented at a slow pace, which he says is largely due to the lack of funds. Despite that challenge, he says, the former warring parties will form a transitional government of national unity at the end of the pre-transitional period in May this year.
If everything goes well, we are going to form a government of national unity in May, which will include all the political parties. This government will last for 3 years and will be followed by a national election. So I call upon you to prepare yourselves for that election.
Kiir is expected to visit the Gogrial state capital, Kwajok, tonight as part of his regional tour. He will also visit Awil, capital of the former northern Bahr al-Ghazal state, as well as Raja, the Lol state capital. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
More than 200 South Sudanese employees of the oil company Pioneer Operating Company say they will go on strike unless their employers pay their allowances approved more than 5 years ago, and also improve what the employees call discriminatory working conditions. The head of the Petroleum and Mining Workers Trade Union says the government and the oil companies must stop ignoring workers' demands. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
In May of 2013, oil companies, the Petroleum Ministry and the state-owned Nile Petroleum Corporation agreed to pay oil sector employees allowances for housing and overtime as well as a market adjustment allowance to compensate for the loss in value of the local currency against the dollar. According to a resolution endorsed by petroleum companies and government officials in May 2013, employees in grades 8 through 10 were supposed to receive $750 per month, and those in grades 11 through 18 were entitled to $1,000 a month. Managers would receive $1,500 per month. John Kalkoch, a GPOC field production engineer, says he has worked for the oil company for 9 years, in Sudan and now in South Sudan. GPOC is a consortium of Malaysian, Chinese, Indian and South Sudanese oil companies which operate in Block 1A and Block 1B in the former Unity State. Kalkoch says working conditions in Sudan were far better compared to those in South Sudan. In Sudan, employees work a certain job for 2 years, then get upgraded to a new post to make room for younger workers. In South Sudan, Kalkoch says a worker stays in the same grade for more than 7 years with a fixed salary.
We have the marketing adjustment allowances that we have. We're supposed to get it, and then we didn't get it up to now. And then also we have something like fuel allowances. And then we are not getting anything. It is there in the policy. And also we have a problem for the training.
Kalkoch says there is no yearly training in South Sudan like there is in Sudan. He says the employees have agreed to go on strike if nothing happens after a week. GPOC Field Lab Supervisor Nimeri Manuel says GPOC has not sent its employees for training of any kind for the past 6 years. And Mayual says it's unfair that foreign workers earn far more than South Sudanese employees, yet they endure the same chemical hazards when in the fields.
In terms of pay, it's not equal, because like me, I am a supervisor. So the difference between me and my crossship, who is not nationalist, there is a very great difference. So as we bear the same impact of chemical hazard, and we bear the same consequences.
Karim Charles, who is the head of drivers for the Sud Services Company Limited, a GPO contractor, says he has worked with the company for the past 7 years. He says GPO has been withdrawing employees' benefits yearly. In addition, Charles says drivers used to get an allowance for cleaning the office cars, but GPO management ended that arrangement. He says the same thing happened with overtime pay.
Our overtime is been paid for 4 years now. Whenever we ask, they will tell us it is in our office. When we go and claim in our office will say that they doesn't know the time where when we are ending, it is supposed to be paid here in Egypt. But when we talk to them, but no one will answer our complaint.
Dut Bakwal, chairman of the Petroleum and Mining Sector Workers Trade Union, says another consortium of oil companies called DPOC pays its employees the agreed to allowances, but GPOC has yet to do so. He says employees are also concerned about delays in the bonus payments as well as a 2-month delay in payment of their basic salary as promised by the Minister of Petroleum.
We started the resumption in August 2018, and the ministries went to the field and it seen all the job were done by the staff, and he so become happy. So that why he want to motivate the staff, giving the 2 month basic salary. It's not the full salary.
Wall says employees will strike if nothing materializes, but prefer that government and JPOC management respond to their grievances before the strike deadline. Efforts to reach Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lulgat Kwoth for comment were unsuccessful. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
An American nonprofit called Water is Basic says it has rehabilitated around 1,000 water points across South Sudan. Steve Rouse, the president of Water is Basic, says his group will continue to provide water to returning South Sudanese refugees and those who had been living in IDP camps. He says Despite the insecurity in parts of Yoyo River State, his team has been providing services to residents affected by the conflict.
Most people do not have access to clean water. Most people do not have the financial resources to solve that problem. And so most young girls and moms walk many, many kilometers to seek water, oftentimes water that comes home and makes their families sick. Those people who do have the resources to drill a borehole on their own, etc., are quite rare.
And I mean, a country like South Sudan with a lot of needs, you know, anywhere you go, people are just, you know, they need your help. You must be having a lot of money to do such a huge project. I mean, who funds you?
So we are funded by grants from foundations. We are funded by churches. We are funded by individuals. We are funded by school children who do fundraisers as a group, as also as individuals doing little lemonade stands on the side of the road, etc. We are funded by matching gifts to employees by their employers. So we have a lot of people from a lot of different places who help fund our work. Again, because we're local, the work is actually much less expensive than it would be if it was all run from outside the country. And during the Civil War, we made a conscious decision to move from drilling only new boreholes to our majority of our work is repairing old water wells that have been around for some time. Thousands of them been drilled, but they've gone unfunctioning as people have left their homes, as they've left and become refugees or IDPs, and those wells have not been used. They need very simple repair to make them functional again.
And you recently went to South Sudan. I saw your photos on the national television. You met the authorities in South Sudan. Tell me about your engagement with the authorities there.
John, I would say from the governor of Yei River State to the administration of Yei River State to the president of South Sudan, His Excellency Salva Kiir, everyone I met had the same sense. Everybody's tired of war. Everybody wants peace. They want forgiveness. And one of my themes was we need to heal from trauma. Everybody's traumatized. And there was a common agreement to that. That was a key point. There just seemed to be a sense, if I had to use a word for it, I felt like everybody used this term, enough is enough. And it gave me great hope as peace is beginning to spread.
When people are saying that they are tired of war and they want peace, and this is coming from the authorities, but they have been saying that from 2015 and they went back to war in 2016. Is there anything new that they are putting on the table which is different from what they have been doing?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I often have to answer that question. How come these folks who finally received their own country went back to war? I think we underestimate the history of a country like South Sudan, where almost everyone has never experienced anything but war. War broke out in 1955, so we have generations of people who've only understood war, difficulty, hunger, lack of medicine, fighting, etc. So I think we overestimated what would happen when there was a cessation of hostilities with the North. Then we were all greatly disappointed to see things break out the way they did in 2013. And I can tell you that Archbishop Elias Taban and I personally met with Riek Machar in July of 2013 and begged him to choose peace. And obviously that's not what happened. But what I'm seeing now is even at every level, every government official, a real fatigue. It's like before there seemed to be still interest in doing whatever it takes to fight for whatever reason they were fighting. But now there seems to be a genuine sense of we do not want to fight anymore. We don't want to suffer anymore. We don't want our families to suffer anymore. We don't want our villages to suffer anymore. Let's do what we can to seek peace. And I think you're seeing the signing of the Revitalized Peace Agreement. Just recently, several of Thomas Cirillo's soldiers signed a peace agreement in Yei River State. They're actually saying, we don't want to keep fighting either. There's just a genuine sense that fighting is not the way to the future.
That's Steve Rousey, president of the American nonprofit Water is Basic. He was speaking to me from the city of Texas, from Dallas, Texas, last week. In the second part of our interview tomorrow, Rousey talks about the challenges of operating in Yei River State. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the rights of children with disabilities. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe Africa can do without aid from Western powers? Why or why not?
Yes, we have so many things. We are blessed as Africans. We have fertile soil. Without even applying like manure or something of that kind, you can still plant. We have so many things that can earn us living without getting aid from the Western countries.
Africa with no aid from US, I think it's a big no. We are not yet there.
Africa has everything it needs. We have a population. We also have resources. What we need is actually leadership and a change of the value system.
Africa can do it. Africa is capable of doing without that aid. One country, Libya, if Libya was able to do it without the Western aid, we are all able to do it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. Today we are talking about the rights of disabled children. Human rights advocates are calling for an end to the discrimination that denies children with disabilities the same right to equal education and other opportunities available to other children in society. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UN Human Rights Council is holding a special session on the empowerment of children with disabilities.
In keeping with the theme of the day, the UN has made the council chamber wheelchair accessible, has hired a sign interpreter for the hearing impaired, and has embossed some oral statements in Braille. With these accommodations to children with disabilities, the UN is sending a message that it practices what it preaches. It is saying children with disabilities will be able to lead a full and fulfilling life on a par with other children if certain adaptations are made to their needs. However, the United Nations reports the sad reality is that 93 million children with disabilities around the world are likely to have their rights violated from the moment they are born. It says millions of these children are torn from their families and placed in institutions where they are at risk of violence, abuse, and neglect. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is a medical doctor and a pediatrician. In her practice, she says she quickly learned the voices of disabled children too often go unheard.
While preparing for today, I was remembering when I just started to be a pediatrician how people will leave the situation of children with disabilities. It was much more complicated, people denied, people hide those children. They will put them sort of in boxes so they won't really be able to develop. They will speak, even doctors, in front of the children like if they didn't hear, that they didn't exist.
Experts debating the issue agree children with disabilities must be provided with an education on an equal basis with all children. They consider this a crucial step toward their empowerment and the realization of other key rights. They say the empowerment of children with disabilities also depends upon the implementation of laws, policies, and measures to tackle harmful social norms and protect them from discrimination, stigma, and abuse. High Commissioner Bachelet says children with disabilities are among the most likely to be left behind and the least likely to be heard. She says they have the right to raise their voices and to be heard in decisions affecting their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Human trafficking takes on different forms and victimizes millions every year, including refugees and immigrants. It is difficult to know the exact number of people trafficked each year. Bandak Lul, a research project director at Arizona State University's Office of Sex Trafficking Intervention, says a lack of knowledge of U.S. laws and fear of deportation often encourages immigrants' victims to stay silent. He says those who are victims of human trafficking can benefit from the Department of Homeland Security resources.
The United States Department of Homeland Security and also the policymakers in 2001, they came out and enacted the trafficking law. And this allows for individuals to be helped. IRC is one of those organizations that has been given the funding, also the resources to help immigrants in general. So IRC provides services from housing here in Phoenix. We have our international rescue community that helps, you know, with housing, medical attentions, legal services, and anything beyond that the victims need. Also, victims are allowed to overstay the visas, or also are given the T visa, which is the trafficking victim visa, that allows them to stay here in the United States as the case is being handled by lawmakers as well as in court. So this way they can go and testify. So there are all these services that are provided that a lot of people that are not aware of because they're afraid if they go on and try to fight against their trafficker, they will be deported.
Yeah, and that's actually a great segue to my next question, because I remember during a conversation that I had with you when I was in Phoenix, you mentioned that there are victims who are afraid of seeming like they are the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. So what should someone do if they are a victim that has been wrongfully accused?
Well, if you're a victim that's been wrongfully accused, I think with all these services that are available, you should seek legal advice from them. People from higher up are also those who are working at federal agents probably don't have the proper knowledge, also the awareness that they need regarding how to assist victims and also how to view victims as a victim rather than a criminal. So in this case, I think victims should go to those who are community-based organizations in position to help them. It is also helpful for victims to talk about their experience to those in power. This helps those in power to be educated on the situation.
And I'm sure that the different immigrant communities are uniquely positioned to help victims. Just looking at the South Sudanese community in particular, how can they help the fight against human trafficking? And just if you would give a report card out right now on the South Sudanese community, do you think that they are doing a good job? Do you think they could do more to protect and help victims and, you know, spread the word out? Or do you think that this is an issue that no one's even talking about?
I think it's an issue that is overlooked. No one is even talking about. Even our own government officials are not even touching the issue at hand. So I think there needs to be a start somewhere for us to start a conversation. And this is why not too long ago I published an article at Cursor, which is a Sudanese-based website where you can go and read about mental health in our community, read about the issues of alcohol, and read about any issues that we're facing in our community. So by starting a conversation, this will help us understand the issue at hand. And from there on, we can go forward and deal with it.
That's Bandak Lul, a research project director at Arizona State University. He was speaking with my colleague Ayen Deng Bior from Phoenix, Arizona. We now turn to Rwanda, where the government has denied reports that it deployed more troops on its border with Uganda amid bilateral tensions. But the foreign minister says the government continues to recommend that Rwandans not travel to Uganda because of security concerns. Eugene Uimana has more for VOA from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Since the Rwandan government last week warned citizens not to travel to Uganda, Ugandans and some domestic critics say the number of soldiers patrolling the border has increased dramatically. Rwandan Foreign Affairs Minister Richard Sezibera today dismissed that concern.
There are no additional troop deployments on our borders. Our country is well defended, and there is no need to do anything extra.
Minister Sezibera also denied claims that Rwandan's borders to Uganda are closed, but he says Rwandans still are advised not to travel to Uganda.
No, Gatuna is not closed. It will not be closed. None of Rwanda's borders are closed. Yeah? Rwandans are strongly advised not to cross into Uganda, not to go to Uganda.
There have been reports for several days that traffic at most border crossings has been shut down from the Rwandan side with no clear explanation from Kigali. Since in 2016, when already the prickly relationship between Uganda and Rwanda relations grew tense, many projects of the East African community have been stunted, especially those involving both countries. Rwanda is a landlocked country that relies on Tanzania's Dar es Salaam port and also Kenya's Mombasa port, which is reached via Uganda. Sezibera says the diplomatic tensions create a challenge for Rwanda's exports.
But you see, you cannot have free movement of goods without free movement of people. It's a problem. You cannot say, let the goods move, but I will arrest those who are transporting those goods.
Rwanda accuses Ugandan authorities of abducting and illegally detaining Rwandans in Uganda and harboring forces who seek to destabilize Rwanda. On Tuesday, Uganda's Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa issued a public letter denying those accusations. Some Ugandans claim that relatives who work in Rwanda are harassed by officials there. Ugandan Parliament member Pius Wakabi urges leaders to quickly sort out the matter.
Are losing jobs in Rwanda. Slowly, they say, your contract is over, just abruptly like that. I think there is need for Parliament of Uganda to look into this matter.
Since tensions began to chill, President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda have met, but their talks have made no progress. The two countries share languages, and many families have members living across the border. Students and workers from both countries have routinely crossed the border for jobs and school until traffic at main border crossings started last week. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Gutamiza by Radio and Whistle featuring B2C. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for inviting us into your homes and vehicles. If you would like to comment on what you hear on this show, our email is southsudan@voanews.com. Again, southsudan@voanews.com. If you are traveling out of Juba, where there are no FM stations, you can still listen to us on our shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kHz, 13865 kHz, and 15180 kHz. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Negalira munyumba ya mainja na komerera misumari. Ah, your love is so wicked, love. So wicked, love, so wicked, love. I wanna feel your body tattoo your name on my face. You're so tempting. But even close, I come like a smile on my face. Like a tuba cueva femores. Sing my bandicida formula. Yes, I'm a compia. I wanna open your binocular. I'm a student, I'm a vegan. I'm a singular. Maybe our love is never to rest. Oh,